The committee, I think that before we begin, Commissioner, it's just great that you're there, that you're ready to go. But I think I would like to have introductions. Now, we are missing, I think, four of our people. I know one person is not going to be here today, but I don't know about the other members. But when they come, we can at some point introduce ourselves. I would like to introduce a few of the staff people to you to begin with, and then members will introduce ourselves. Let me introduce first Tangi Harrison, is our new committee administrator. She's replacing Katie Brewer. None of us both pretend that we can really replace Katie. We'd love to. We would love to have cloned her, but Tangi brings an excellent background in the private sector to the committee, and a really great, wonderful curiosity about issues and a passion for policy. So I'm excited to have her working with us, and she's a quick study. She served as a committee LA legislative assistant last session, learned a lot from Katie, right, and not just what to do, but even sometimes more importantly, how to do it. So she's friendly. She knows how important relationships are to senators and to staff and to agencies, to the House, everybody in the department, the governor's office, and, of course, lobbyists, certainly not least, perhaps most importantly, to the public. So that's a real plus. And she respects the process and isn't afraid to help me do better. Tell me how to do better. She has a great son, Blake, and I think she's working to make the world a better place for Blake, too, right? Jamie Olson came to the Capitol as an intern last session. Katie thought she just had great enthusiasm. I think she was really interested in wine with dinner, in case anybody's ears perked. If I recall, that was one of the things, yeah. But we're not doing that today, nor anytime soon. Not to worry, but... Jamie graduated from the university last spring and has been working at West Publishing. I'm not sure what the name of it is these days, but anyway, since graduation, we know it as that, I guess. I love that she spent 9 months in Sweden learning the language and experiencing the culture, and she did it for those reasons, to do those things. So I think that's cool. She also worked at the Swedish Council of America. I think she's Swedish, if I'm not mistaken. I think that you can't be in that family and not be Swedish, it sounds like. Bea Ludens is back for her... I thought maybe you'd gone up to the Senate. For her third session as our committee page. Bea has been a friend of mine for over 30 years now, and I think she's a great role model for younger pages, and has a real respect for the institution as well. So she knows just about everybody in this room. At the Capitol, she's kind of our ambassador, and we're glad she came back. She's been very active in politics. That's how I got to know her in 30-some years ago. And I think I'm 10 or 11 days older than she is, so we're generationally matched here. Then I would like to introduce, on my right, Chris Stang, who is our the Senate Counsel Office and counsel to our committee. Chris, I'm going to ask you to describe, what you can do. Yeah.
Can I hand this off?
Oh, is this about the jurisdiction?
I'll wait. Our office and the jurisdiction.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Okay? That's cool. Yeah.
Why don't I do that?
Okay. And then we'll get yeah.
Yeah, I can just get started. I'm Senate Counsel for the Commerce Committee. I've worked for the nonpartisan office of Senate Counsel Research and Fiscal Analysis, and I've been staffing the committee, I think, for about 11 years now. So I believe, with the exception of Senate President Metzen, I might have more tenure at this table than any of the other members, so I don't know. Darlene Sleewood on my right is the research analyst from our office, and she can introduce herself as well. But Mainly, the top sheet I handed out is just kind of describes what our office does here in the Senate. Might be especially useful to the new members, and maybe a good refresher for the members who've been around for a while. But as I said, we're the nonpartisan office. Our support for the committee mainly relates to the area of we draft bills within the subject matter jurisdiction of the committee and amendments to bills before us. We advise the committee on the effect of legislation that it is considering. We staff the committee hearings. We answer questions directed to us with respect to the jurisdiction of the committee. Essentially, we're the go-to people in the Senate on issues of jurisdiction under the Commerce Committee, which I'll address briefly in a moment. Darlene has just been hired by our office. She's the research analyst, so over time she'll be doing most of the policy research, whereas I will probably tend to do most of the legal research and legal drafting and so forth for the committee. But we're a full service office. We're here to help, and we look forward to working with you during the course of the session.
And in other words, I would for sure keep this. You may want to take it with you or keep it in your folder. We'll keep things that you want to save. We won't throw this kind of thing out because this is something particularly the new members. We have three new senators, actually, on our committee. So and a whole bunch of new people. So I think 7 of the 10 people are brand new. But you may want to keep that along with some other things. Darlene, did you want to say?
No, I think Chris pretty much covered it. But I'm happy to answer any questions or research anything that you might be interested in.
And Dave Jensen back there is the fiscal analyst.
I'm Dave Jensen. I'm the fiscal analyst part of the office. I review the bills for appropriations or fiscal implications, and I request and review fiscal notes. So I'm part of the team, too.
Okay. Thank you. And then we have over here at the table in the corner, is it Sandy? Sandra Boone, who is the Senate DFL research person, and is it Dan Mecklenburg for the Senate Republican Caucus? Is there anybody that I've forgotten up here at the table? Just the senators. So, Senator Sparks, if you would just introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's obviously a pleasure to be back here with you again. I'm honored to be your vice chair. Look forward to working with you. I'm Senator Dan Sparks. I represent Southern Minnesota, Freeborn, Maurer, and 4 townships in Fillmore County, and this is my second term, so I look forward to working with the old members and certainly with the new members as well as we address many of these important commerce issues.
Thank you.
And I'm John Marty, and I'm glad to be back on the Commerce Committee. Much smaller committee than I remember last time I disappeared.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan Scogan, representing Senate District 10, Ottertail, Wadena, small part of Becker County. New to the game, excited to be here.
Okay. I'm Senator Mary Olson, representing Central Lakes area up through northern Minnesota to just north of Bemidji. I have a background as an attorney and a consumer citizen advocate. I'm very excited to be on this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Debbie Johnson, Senate District 49, Andover, Ham Lake, Hoon Rapids. I've been trying since 2002 to get on this committee, and not because of wine in the grocery store, but I really am interested in consumer and commerce policy, and I'm glad to be here.
I'm Yvonne Pretner-Solon, representing District 7, which is Duluth, and I've been trying to get on the committee since 2003, so I am thrilled to be a member of the committee.
If I tell you the track record of the former members of this committee, you might not want to be on it. Oh, dear, at least as far as elections go, so we lost an awful lot of people. Again, I want to welcome everybody. This is our first meeting, obviously, of the 2007 session. Since the election in November, we've heard about how we're going to be more collaborative, work together better, more. Since I came to the Senate and was appointed to the Commerce Committee back in 1996, actually my first term started in 97, It was chaired by Senator Sam Solon. Since then, since I got on this committee has stood out as an example of, I think, of bi or even tripartisan collaborative working together. I think we've done that really well. By his example and his leadership, Senator Solon, I would like to say, taught me how to chair a committee. You want every person who comes before us to be welcomed and feel valued for what their concern is and what knowledge they have to share with us, their experience. You want all sides to be heard and be respected. Sam, though, took it one step further. He would admonish parties who were disputing over controversial legislation to work those things out before they came to his committee. Thank you very much. And it didn't mean we didn't have controversy. Of course we did. But I've heard Senator Pogemiller talk about this and using Senator Solon's example and his style. And I think there's a lot to that. And so I've never forgotten that wisdom of his. And each year I'm trying to do a little better job at emulating his style. Like I said, that doesn't mean we won't have controversy. We're bound to. But it does mean we're going to try to work on and work out issues before we hear bills, if you can. And then if you can't, we're going to try to do the same thing in the committee and try to work those things out. I think what this means to me is that balance is important to the work of this committee. Because I see our mission as one is of balancing the interests of consumers. And consequently, we've added consumer protection to the name of the committee to remind ourselves that that's part of the balance. And then balanced with a marketplace that's allowed to work with as few restraints as possible. I'm understanding that the subject areas, the issue areas that we deal with, consider some extremely major elements of consumer expenditures, if you will, real estate, homes, financial investments, financial products, insurance coverages from health to homeowners and auto and liability, life insurance. All of those are extremely important expenditures on the part of consumers. So it is important that there be regulation. I think everybody in the room agrees with that. What we're going to try to do is to balance those interests. I'm so looking forward to this session, and I expect we're going to have a variety of bills. We do everything here. We've done fireworks. We have a bill about where you can make an American flag or where you can buy, where it has to be made if you're going to buy it here, and to liquor regulation, real estate, insurance, banking, some really interesting subject areas, and there's always that variety every session. We're going to work hard to have things ready for prime time when they leave here. Senator Pogemiller has asked that we do get our bills ready to go and do as much work as we can do in the committee. So we're going to try to do that heavy lifting right in here. And by the way, I'm glad we're back in Joe Rolette's room, and he kept us all meeting in St. Paul. As opposed to St. Peter. I don't want to offend anybody from St. Peter, but I'm glad I just had to come from to St. Paul this morning. An interesting history, if you want. I don't know if it tells it up there. I think it does, anyway. He kind of stole the Capitol and kept us all here. Anyway, we're going to, if bills come before us and we can't work it out, I think we'll be more prone to lay them over rather than send them on and wait for other committees, or I hope that other committees will do the work we didn't finish. If I was guilty of anything, in the last couple of years, it was probably that, and I want us to really get our work done here. We tried to get the committee meeting earlier, get bills in front of us. If we had had bills, we'd be hearing bills today. We just have a couple of bills referred to us. And it's just kind of the nature of this animal, the legislature. Anyway, we're not going to have all the bills in front of us, and some of the more controversial ones tend to take longer even to develop. But the truth of the matter is, we're going to be moving when we start doing bills and try to get our work done in case something has to go on to another committee. Always look at your bill to see if that's the case. And I can particularly give testimony to the fact that some of my bills had to go to judiciary which meant they were dying. but now I'm on the Judiciary Committee, so you know, sometimes you just have to take things in your own hands. No, that's not exactly how it works, but I, you know, was hoping that I might fool somebody with it. You know, my style is more like mom than queen, so I nag a little probably. And but we don't have real rigid requirements. We're pretty. We have fun, and I think that's important to do. I ask people to come to meetings on time if you can, because we now have an hour and a half for lunch or whatever it is you're going to do between 11 and 12:30. So we can all be here at 12:30, right? And if I can't be, Senator Sparks is going to chair the meeting for me, but I'm going to be here. But I would like to start promptly and properly with a quorum when we have bills before us. I do like hearing requests. They help us. They help staff know how much time to set aside for a bill. And sometimes, you know, you can only give an estimate, but we can tell a little bit about, you know, we're going to know a little more when we see how many people you want to have coming to the hearing. We get notices for the hearings. We promise to do a good job of getting notices about hearings out in a timely way. For example, we will be meeting on Tuesday, but probably not on Thursday. And we don't have bills yet with requests, but next Tuesday, Commissioner Wilson, who's here today, is going to be back again for a confirmation hearing. The Senate confirmed him 4 years ago when he was appointed, but we have to go through that process again, and the governor has sent that letter of appointment to us, and so we'll be ready to do that on Tuesday. And so we will be doing that. And, you know, I think that next Thursday we're hoping to maybe do an insurance 101. I'm not sure it'll be on Thursday, but that'll be for people who really, you know, I want members to know. If you know everything there is to know about insurance, I guess you don't have to come, but it'll be kind of like a class. And to be really honest with you, I didn't want to use committee time for those kinds of things, but there's no other time with everybody's schedule and with committees. So, and people are even scheduling things over lunch, so we couldn't even do that for some of our things we want to do. I want to point out that one of the first things that Tangi Harrison did was to put together a pamphlet that's in your packet today, and you may want to keep it there or take it back and read it, about liquor regulation. There's no test, and we're not discussing it today. But that's one of the questions a lot of people have on this committee is how in the world do we regulate alcohol in Minnesota or spirits in Minnesota? So this is a real good synopsis, but you wanted to know, and so she examined it. And Frank, we may try to do that with some other issue areas as well, but I don't think we're going to do a whole lot of review of every area, but that's something that you can have and look at and refer to. With that, I think we have a couple more senators who have come in, and would you like to introduce yourself? I'm Senator Shides, Senator Vandeveer. I don't think we've actually officially met, but
I don't believe so. I'm Ray Vandeveer. I'm from Senate 52, Forest Lake, and very happy to be on the committee.
Do you have a background, and you can tell us a little something?
Oh, certainly. I'm a small business owner. I own Associate Appraisers. It's located in St. Anthony, and I'm also a real estate broker. And we've been in business, in the appraisal business, since 1983, I believe.
Okay.
So,
well, welcome.
Welcome
to the committee, Senator Gerlach.
Good afternoon. Chris Gerlach. I represent Apple Valley, Rosemount, and Burnsville. And I'm glad to be back on the Commerce Committee. I was in the House for three terms before I came over to the Senate, and I was on the Commerce Committee with Greg Davids as the chairman. In those days, if you know Greg, it was always a fun time, a lot of variety with issues and how we dealt with them. So I'm glad to be back on the Commerce Committee. And in real life, I'm a real estate agent with Coldwell Banker Burnett in Apple Valley, and glad to be here.
And then, members, I should say that I should maybe give a little bit of my background. This will be my fourth year chairing the committee. The first year of our last term, I didn't chair the Commerce Committee, so I didn't start until the second year of that term. But I've served in the Commerce Committee for a number of years. It was financial institutions and insurance when I first sat on this committee in the House some years ago and have a background in real estate, some bit of mortgage banking. I've practiced law a little bit. I'm reminded, and I obviously am a politician, and I've never sold any used cars, though, so I've done all those things. I'm reminded of when I went to I had won a term in the Minnesota House, and then I lost, and so I went. I decided to get my real estate license, and my first night at school, the instructor said, "Well, welcome to the world, to the real estate profession. You're going to find soon enough that the public holds realtors in not very high esteem." By the way, I think that has changed a whole lot, but this is a long time ago. And he said, in fact, it's just one notch above politicians. And I was so excited because I knew I was on my way up. So here I am, and I told you the thing. I'm looking for balance between consumer interests and the marketplace, and I think we've done a pretty good job of working that out in this committee over the years. With that, we're going to get going. I'm sure Commissioner and your staff would like to see us get moving here, but we had to do all of this and find out who each other is, and so that you would know who we are as well. Welcome to the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee, Commissioner. Commissioner Glenn Wilson is going to oversee an overview of the Commerce Department, with whom we work really on a, you know, weekly basis. I mean, there is always something that involves the department before our committee. And he has really good people with him. And, Commissioner, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, I am fortunate to have had the opportunity to meet all of you. And I'm honored today to be back for a second term appointed by the governor. It's a real honor. It's a pleasure for me also to be here on behalf of the department that we've worked in for 4 years, the staff that you'll meet 4 years together. We're pretty proud of what we've been able to accomplish. And I can tell you, Senator, that I believe firmly that the model that you outlined, Senator Sam Solon's model, is one that I believe that your committee and our department has worked well together in that regard. And I would commit to another term of working in the Sam Solon model together with these issues. And so with that, I would like to very briefly go through some of the direct reports, and three of them will help me here today with the presentation. But before I do, I think that it's important that the committee and our department and the public understand the breadth. I'm reminded often of when I'm thinking about the department, it reminds me of a river near our home. Its reputation is that it's a mile wide and a foot deep. And to a large degree, it pretty well describes the very broad portfolio of activity that we regulate in the department. But to help me with all that, Pat Sexton is here today as Government Affairs Director, has been in several administrations, very well known, and does an outstanding job. Pat and John Gross, 38 years with the department, probably the most outstanding source of information relative to healthcare. It took me about 2 years to realize that I was not only the one that was most dependent on John, but the health department and DHS and about anybody that has to do with insurance. John, are you here? I think everybody knows you. Outstanding resource for the department. And Tom Hagan is the rookie of the team, but even he has previous experience with the department. Came on board about 3 years ago. His term with our department was interrupted by a year's service in Iraq as a senior officer in the JAG Corps there. Came back 2 months ago and is assistant commissioner to the commissioner on administrative group. Tom?
Welcome back.
That covers the highlights. And one of the things that I think that we remind ourselves, and I'll read it, not because I don't it's a first time or don't believe it or whatever, but the mission of the department, because we look at it every day, we do take it seriously. Our mission is to ensure equitable commercial and financial transactions and reliable energy services by regulating and licensing business activities in more than 20 industries, investigating and resolving consumer complaints, advocating the public's interest before the Public Utilities Commission, and administering various state programs. To do all that and be consistent and balanced, too, I appreciate very much, Madam Chairman, the comment on balance, because it was the same direction I was given 4 years ago when I was interviewed by the governor, when he said to me that one of the more difficult positions in government is in the Commerce Department, because in every case it's a balance between the business interest and the consumer. And we try every day to balance and weigh that out. But to do that, I have to tell you that there's 320 people in our department, and a lot of these specialty areas have as few as one person. But a large area of special interest in our department is six or eight. So it's very, very broad but shallow. But I do count on not only – I don't know, honestly, 4 years ago when I was appointed what to expect in terms of the staff that I inherited. Many of them have been there a long time. But I can tell you now, after 4 years of working with them every day, that I'm very pleased to find that there's absolutely no difference in the staff that I have and any that I found and was proud of in business. They're well-educated, hardworking, want to do the absolute best they can. And I always feel as though today, as I did then, that if somehow they're misdirected or unappreciated, it's because of the lack of direction, not because of the lack of their background and interest in wanting to do the right thing. In addition to that, I found it took maybe as much as a year, as some of you new members of the Commerce Committee might appreciate, to get a complete confidence so that as a representative of the department and the governor, that I could come before a committee like this or the public or whomever and feel confident in the information that was given me. And I have to tell you that it took a little while to appreciate the fact that we have 63 people in the department with advanced degrees. I can count on their unembellished counsel in almost every instance. It doesn't matter whether it's one of the good number of attorneys, scientists, economists, and actuaries. And yesterday, Senator, we were visiting briefly, and I mentioned that one of the things that distinguishes our department, not that I have good counsel with degreed and experienced, but it's dead on the money that after 4 years, I know that to be true, and I'm confident in it. But a good example is the fact that most states don't have an actuary in their insurance area. We have three. And of those three, they're probably among the highest. There's a good number of people in this room that go to the NAIC meetings on a regular basis. They will tell you, as I do, that it's typical of the department that our three actuaries are among the most respected in the nation. Sometimes they're a little difficult, but they are very sound in their recommendations. I know I'm taking a little bit more of your time, but I do think that it's important that we focus on some of the real activities. I'm proud of the fact, too, that one of the things that we focused on in the last 4 years is when I came to the department, I found this outstanding staff in place, but poor systems, and very as many as 20 years behind times in what I had found in the business world as to be able to support the staff. But at the same time, I'd like to say how we've restructured and give two brief examples. We used to have our investigators throughout the department that would transcribe the records of court hearings, hearings at the legislature, witness hearings, and they would take the time. They were very poor at transcribing. Now we have an elite team that transcribes these records, makes them available to the investigators so that the investigators spend more time investigating and less time trying to transcribe these records. That's only one example. But another area that I'm very proud of, took me a little while to fully appreciate, is Nancy Link's team. We call it the CR team, or the Consumer Response Team. They handle 34,500 calls a year on an insurance. Any of you that are familiar with insurance law, it's pretty complicated and there's volumes. These people handle calls every day without the knowledge of who's calling, what purpose, and as long as it has to do with insurance, they take it up. They do an outstanding job of representing the consumer, working them through their policy. And rather than belabor this fact, I'd like to read the most recent correspondence I got from a consumer, because I think it's reflective of a lot of the correspondence that I get. On May 15th, my husband, Tom Rojas, passed away. About a month later, I realized that I was in no win battle with the two life insurance companies. Someone recommended I call the Department of Commerce. The person who answered the phone that day I called was Bubba Aguilar. He listened to me very patiently as I described what I was going through with the insurance companies. And over the next few months, Bubba made the calls for me that I didn't want to make or that I was too frustrated to make. He constantly kept in touch with me, returned my calls promptly, sat in on a conference call with me and the representative of one of the companies, and he heard the lies that I was being told by them. On October 31st, I received my final insurance payment 5.5 months after my husband died. I truly do believe that I would still be waiting for my husband's insurance money if it weren't for the help of Bubba. And I want to thank the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and especially Bubba, for helping me through this very tough time. Thank you, Nancy Rojas. And Bubba's our rookie. It takes a lot of training, and Nancy's very good at it. And like I say, it took a little bit of time to appreciate all that. But that's representative of two small areas of the department. I think all of you have a handout in front of you, and on page 4, in a very broad fashion, you can see on the top line our general revenue appropriations have gone down, and I believe that that's largely due to the fact that we have installed considerable amount of improved process. Allowing
page 2, excuse me.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's right. That's right. Department budget at the top, right?
Yes. And anyway, that's not the area that I'm most proud of, but when you look down across to the bottom line, it says total revenues collected, $152 million, I'm sorry. It's now only 12% of the cost of our department. And that I am proud of. One of the things that I thought that two things I'd like to point out is licensing fees have been rather flat. Well, that's not a true reflection, because notaries, cosmos, and builders have been moved into other areas of government for oversight. And so their loss of their licensing revenue has been taken out. So actually, the number of licensees is up. But anyway, most of it comes from unclaimed properties, increased fines are represented in that all other revenue line. That's up about $2 million from historic levels. And the unclaimed property, I'll touch on that a little bit more in a few minutes. But one of the things that I've mentioned already that we feel confident and excited about is because the department is so broad and covers with so many different industries, one or two systems are totally inadequate. We've installed 14 major systems in the last 2 years, more than any business that I've been familiar with or engaged in. And I'll go through just quickly a couple and how it affects the department so all of you are aware. In the unclaimed properties, wagers, we take the data. We used to do all that by paper. Today, the $88 million worth of paper represented in 23,000 pieces of property is done online. And it's all electronic. It's tracked in the department online, and the proof of ownership and disposition of the property is online. Zircon is a system that we've installed for licensing. It was installed to license insurance licensees. There were a few years ago 74,000. It's up to 101,000 of these licenses, and that doesn't include about 7,700 agencies and 1,700 companies. That is now online, and to tell you how that plays out, in the past, when you sent in your check for a renewal of your license, it was presumed that you were licensed because it took us 5 months to process. 2 months ago, we did 35,500 renewals of insurance online. We never touched the paper or the payments. And so that the next move is with Pulse to do realtors and the other industries. Along with that, we are installing a system for tracking continuing education. If you can imagine for a moment that we license 244,000 people in the department, 20 industries. Over the years, we've approved 22,000 courses for continuing education. We approve about 1,800 of them every year. And many of the licensees have to have 15 hours. Some require no continuing education, but many require 15 hours a year. If you multiply that all out, we were to track on paper well over a million, approaching 2 million transactions, and we weren't doing it. It was an impossibility. And we've been criticized a little bit because when HUD, the only area that gets audited for continuing education is when HUD audits the appraisers. The license up to 2002 found significant error in the way that the tracking and the appraisers were reporting their continuing education. As a matter of fact, 500 of them were out of compliance out of the 2,200 that we licensed, which if you extrapolate that across the 244,000 that we licensed, you'd have to believe that somewhere around 40,000 were not being accounted for properly. So the system that we're installing now will be up and running before long. We'll put every person, no matter where they get their continuing education, the sponsor will be required within a couple days to upload that continuing education requirement and the record of their being there so that it can be tracked. I'm taking too much time, but another system that we've installed as an example is the SURF system, where a large number of filings for insurance product can be filed. There's a year ago, we had a slightly less than 1,200 filed online. This year, it's over 1,600. We've upgraded the system so that more industries using it. E-docs. We had rooms full, about rooms larger than the table, probably the pillars, 4 feet deep in documents on utility filings and forms. And anybody that wanted a copy, we had to go down and have copies sent, made and sent out, taking an enormous amount of time because the records and pages accumulated into the millions. Today, they are we mandate that they be filed online, stored online, retrieved by anybody that wants them, and the trade secret information is redacted out automatically so that it's an enormous savings of time, and the public, including the consumers, have access to this information instantly at their home computer. We're doing the tracking same way in weights and measures automatically, and I could go on, but the point is that we've installed systems throughout the department. Mark Brasella is here. Mark, 25 years with the department. He runs the weights and measures area. And weights and measures, most Minnesotans don't realize the dependency that the state business has and the consumers are dependent on. Business looks at it for, we calibrate the weigh scales for more than 600 industries, 39 states, five foreign countries, so that we are recognized. We do four other states as well. They pay the price. But the most important part is that industry is dependent all the way from the manufacturers of pills. The scales calibration is critical. In the same way with railroad cars and the iron ore, so that in everything in between, we set and calibrate in our metrology lab in weights and measures. We do the blending on fuel, whether it's diesel fuel or ethanol, so that the consumer can be depend that the blend is right and that scale is right at the gas station. I could go on about some of the other areas, but the department is highly recognized, along with other departments, as one of the leaders in the nation. When we adopted 2% diesel, biodiesel a year ago, there was no standard for testing that blend on a national basis. We were the first in the nation in the first place to mandate the biodiesel fuel use, but there was no standard. We asked our department, okay, get on it. We had a rough spell in the introduction of the product, but during that period of time, the department and its lab, which has been moved to Burnsville to upgrade it, was able to come up with a standard for testing fuel blends, and now is involved in establishing that as the standard nationally. There are several pages here on that I'll just skip over relative to weights and measures, but in the area of unclaimed property as well, we had 29,000 claims, and if you look at the chart there, that the whether you're looking at the property received, a couple years ago it was $37 million. This year it's $62 million. A year ago we hit a high of $105 million. In claims paid out, which we're most proud of because we've changed the way that we advertise, promote to the public, the fact that we have potentially their claims, that those claims handled in the department have been automated, have gone up from $12,000 a year to $29,000, and the payouts from $12 million to $25 million. And the state still has the benefit of the difference because it goes into the general fund. But this shows the amount of activity and the increase in that activity. Petro Fund is another area that very quickly I'll only point out that it's important. We've been involved in large-scale petroleum leaks and cleanups for a number of years. This document would indicate that while the large sites have basically been done throughout the state, that we now are engaged in, as you can see, more sites and less dollars. It's only because the sites are smaller, not because we're doing less work. Actually, the work has gone up. With that, I'd like to briefly ask that your indulgence, because the energy and telecom is not within the scope of the committee, but it is a major part of our department. I'd like to introduce Ed Garvey, who's previously chairman of the PUC, been with our department for 4 years, and recognized an authority in both the telecom and energy area. Edward?
Mr. Garvey, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. Thank you, Commissioner Wilson, for this opportunity. The Energy and Telecommunications Division has about 75 full-time equivalents. Our responsibilities are broad and extensive, but they focus on overseeing the state's electricity, natural gas, and telephone service providers as their regulators and working with the Public Utilities Commission. Our overall mission is to promote reliable, low-cost, environmentally superior energy systems, and of course with the very helpful guidance from Chair Pretner Solon, we will be able to, be able to do that more and more in the future, and I look forward very much to that, in particular in working with the Governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative package of more renewables, more efficiency, and less carbon. Those will be initiatives that will be coming before her committee, but I just wanted to come before you and give you a quick overview of this part of the very broad purview of Commissioner Wilson's Department of Commerce. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, for this time.
Garvey, thank you. Thank you.
With that, I would like to move to introduce Pat Nelson. Pat was 8 years in the department previously in the area of audit, finance, and the solvency area. Was out in private practice for 4 years, came back 4 years ago to be part of this administration. With that, Pat's also an attorney. And ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name, as the Commissioner indicated, is Pat Nelson, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about the Market Assurance Division and tell you a little bit about my team, sort of continuing on the Commissioner's theme of talking about the talented and dedicated individuals that we have working at the Commerce Department. And so I'd talk a little bit about the breakdown of my area, focusing on sort of my supervisory talent level. The Market Assurance Division has about 82 individuals working in that section. It is kind of broken down into about five teams, but the first one I'll talk about briefly is what I call the front end regulation, and that's securities registration, policy analysis, workers' comp, self-insurance, and assigned risk plan. And why I call it front end regulation is it really deals with our financial products that are sold here in Minnesota, many of which have to be sort of reviewed before they're available to the marketplace for our consumers and the public. So that area works on that environment. Dan Sexton runs the securities side. He's got 36 years of experience. Securities registration is evolving, as you are probably aware. More of it is done at the federal level. It's shared federal and state responsibility. And with some changes in the mid-90s and some changes actually that go into effect for our state law in August, we rewrote the securities laws last year. There's less securities regulation on the front end of sales, but there's still significant securities regulation on the back end regulation on the enforcement side. Workers' comp self-insurance is a program that runs pretty well. It's been pretty static in terms of growth. I think we only added like eight new companies in the last fiscal year that are self-insured. The assigned risk plan, our markets here are pretty healthy. This is the area that sort of reviews sort of where things are in terms of pricing and availability of product. The assigned risk plan, which is the workers' comp residual market pool. The commissioner just signed an order at the end of the year to lower their pricing by about 6%. The pool is actually shrinking. It was over $100 million in September of 2004. I think the last data run I saw was about $46 million. So that's indicative that our comp market here is in pretty good shape relative to the private side, which is pulling people from the residual market, and pricing is dropping both in the private side and in the public side. Our homeowners and our auto markets, we anticipate maybe slight declines over maybe a little bit starting last year going forward. The markets are pretty healthy. Unlike some of the coastal areas, our homeowners insurance has been relatively flat. It did go up in the early 2000s because of the storms, but the pricing is relatively flat now. Won't talk about health insurance because that's a whole other topic. On the other side of the Market Assurance Division, the commissioner already mentioned our consumer response team. Nancy Link has 24 years of commerce experience. Is a very effective manager because, as the commissioner mentioned, they deal with a high volume and are very knowledgeable about their specific sector. If a complaint comes into them and it's more than that can be resolved in sort of a paper phone call area, it gets referred to, I have an insurance investigative unit run by Robert Commodore, who has 30 years of experience at the Commerce Department. They would turn it into more of a file-type setup and a more extensive investigation. If it turns into sort of a pattern and practice kind of situation, then I also have an insurance market conduct team, which is run by Paul Hansen, which has he has 21 years of commerce experience. And that particular unit is relatively small in terms of state employment, but it does have the ability to staff up via contractors if the exams get large and complex. So in that particular environment, that's very nice function to have. Their capacity is somewhat restricted by the number we have to manage. You know, they have to manage the contractors. So it isn't a limitless supply, but it does have some flexibility. On the real estate and security side, that unit is run by Bonnie Pulta with 35 years experience at the Commerce Department. They're responsible for, as the title indicates, real estate and securities. The commissioner will talk a little bit more about mortgage issues and other things that particular unit would work on. The newest unit at the Commerce Department in general is insurance fraud. They are the ones that you guys created several years ago. I think it was funded maybe two sessions ago, so it's been kind of up and running for a year and a half. They have six officers now, four analysts, one support staff, and we are in the process of re-interviewing for the chief law enforcement officer position, and the current supervisor, Penny Kent, is the acting CLEO. And she was, prior to being with the insurance fraud unit at Commerce, she was in insurance fraud at the Department of Labor and Industry, so she has significant state experience also. They are investigating insurance fraud. It's a criminal fraud investigation. And there have already charged out like 23 cases that have been successfully concluded in prosecutions. I think they have like 10 pending in different counties around the state, and they're actively working about 140 files. So it's up and running and fully functional. The last unit I'll discuss briefly is the licensing unit. It's the newest division to be under the market assurance section of commerce. It's obviously been around a long time in terms of function. It has one of our most up-and-coming managers. He's a young fellow. As the commissioner mentioned, he runs the Petro Fund, and he is doing that now, but we're moving him over to licensing. There's a couple slides relating to licensing in your packet, slides 17 and 18, but it's a program that has a great deal of volume, a touchstone for many Minnesota citizens, 244,000 folks. And as the commissioner mentioned, this area is a little bit of a state of transition, so you might hear some things about it during the course of the legislative session. The commissioner mentioned the CIRCON system where we automated the renewal process for insurance, and we're also automating the as you mentioned, the education courses. And as that system works its way through, you might hear from some of your constituents. But it's a system that through the first renewal cycle, the people that I've talked to that used it for renewal were very pleased with its outcome. The next slide on 19, as you mentioned, that's the calls to the CRT unit. It's not the calls to the division in total. We have, for example, tens of thousands of calls that come into licensing and other calls that come in around the different market areas. The chart down below shows the growth in civil penalties that this division collected over the years. You can also see in chart 19 that there's a great deal of volatility there. The trend line is what's illustrative. We don't regulate to sort of make that line grow. Some of the larger cases that impact that line take several years to develop, and we don't like try and schedule them. So you can see that there's volatility, but the trend is I think illustrative of the work we're doing in that area. And with that, just quickly mentioning on slide 21. Just I picked four recent cases that were in the process of being charged out, or in actual, some of them have already been convicted. Just to show you the breadth of the kinds of things we handle in the Market Assurance Division, the first one relates to the Dale Schlichting case, which you may have read about. It was part of it happened down in Maurer County. It was a Ponzi scheme in its main instance, but he was fraudulently creating insurance policies and then absconding with the premiums. The next one referred to as the National School Fitness Program, which was another Ponzi scheme run by some folks out in Utah that were in effect promising schools free fitness. It was kind of a referral from the state auditor's office, but we ended up investigating it at Commerce, working with our new fraud unit, and then eventually turned it over to the FBI and the mail postal folks, and they did get some convictions just recently in that case. The next one I kind of referred to as one that was developed in-house. Mr. Garvey's unit is responsible for payment of some of the subsidies for windmill generation, and they sort of noticed that one of their collectors was the numbers didn't look right, so they referred it to my side of the shop, and we did some investigation, found that he was indeed overstating the generation capacity of his setup, and that's been referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office because the money, I think, comes from them. And the last one is just more of a standardized insurance fraud case, but from one of the early examples of the fraud unit working with local law enforcement. It was a gentleman who was creating phony policies for folks to get their cars out of impound lots up in Brooklyn Park, and he would basically sell them a certificate and not actually obtain the insurance for the customer. That case is ongoing, and actually the locals are prosecuting this time. And I know I took a little too long, but
Mr. Nelson was that?
Yes.
He was selling certificates that so people could show that they had insurance.
Yes, and then they could get their car out, and because you have to show that you have proof of insurance.
You know, I know you're supposed to do that, but it's been my experience with one of the representatives from my district whose father owns a business that he's had to turn over cars where they don't have insurance to people. Well, that's an issue. You should talk to Representative Hillstrom about it because it really bothers him. And that's because we talk about, you know, verification on auto insurance, and it drives him nuts because he knows he can't hold onto a car if he's got an order that it gets released. And so we've even talked to the patrol and all kinds of people about that. So that's just an area that you might check out. He's not, you know, he's the one that's got the cars in the lot, but the impound lot. Very interesting. I couldn't imagine a windmill, but this was a wind generation. I mean, those are windmills. I was picturing the one little tulips over Amsterdam or something. You know, I have one at home that
it's
plays
a great
that.
Big thing.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat. At this time, I'd like to introduce Kevin Murphy. And Kevin was recruited to the department 9 years ago and has a good number of years' experience as a federal auditor for the FDIC of federal chartered banks, regulates the state banks in terms of their financial wherewithal and solvency, both for the financial and the insurance area. Kevin?
Mr. Murphy, hello.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Kevin Murphy, Deputy Commissioner. Next June will be the nine-year mark for me with the Commerce Department. My previous experience is 17 years with the FDIC as a bank regulator, followed by 12 years as a private sector consultant, mostly fending off federal bank regulators, followed by 8.5 years at the Commerce Department. And for those of you doing the math, I'm not really that old. I started with the feds when I was 12. Our division regulates financial institutions, and we encourage a competitive marketplace for financial services, but we want minimal failures and minimal losses to consumers, so we have a balancing act that we go through. We license, examine, and regulate state banks, credit unions, finance companies, and insurance companies. We also license the mortgage originators, which is a hot topic this year. We license check cashers, payday lenders, money transmitters, currency exchanges. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
We have two major parts to my division, one that we call banking that deals with the banks and the credit unions and the like, and that's headed up by Bill Horlitz, who's an FDIC alum, who's a very, very solid guy. He replaced two people that retired, and he can do that standing on his head. we have about 330 state banks and about 100 credit unions. We have partnerships with the federal regulators in that arena. We take turns visiting them every 18 months or so. Total bank assets are in the neighborhood of $35 billion. We have about 46 people in that unit. And the other big piece is the insurance and actuarial component, which is headed by Jackie Gardner, who's a very experienced insurance regulator, has worked in several different states. We have no federal regulator in the insurance world. It's all of the states share that function. We have about 85 companies headquartered in Minnesota that we're responsible for directly regulating. We examine them periodically, usually every 4 or 5 years. And we license another 1,300 insurance companies that are headquartered elsewhere but sell products in Minnesota. And we monitor their financial condition but don't visit them generally. So we do a lot of number crunching in my arena. We also examine the HMOs, the health maintenance organizations, on behalf of the Department of Health. It was discovered a few years ago that our people were better at that than the health department, so we took over that function almost on a contractor kind of an arrangement. In our insurance component, we're the nationwide leader in what I call risk-focused examinations, which is making insurance examinations more like bank examinations in that the focus is on the risky areas of their business rather than simply duplicating what the accounting firms had done for years. So we've been doing that for several years, and that's very effective. We still have some more work to do. The work product that's the result of these efforts is still the same as the old work product, and we're kind of revamping that to make that more meaningful. Where the bank exam reports are confidential, insurance exam reports are public. We post those on our web pages. So if somebody can find their way through our web page, they can surface these exam reports, which are posted periodically. Another component of my division is the mortgage licensing function, and we have 1.5 full-time equivalents devoted to that, and I've been spending a fair amount of my time on that recently. The enforcement function of the mortgage arena is generally done by Pat Nelson's division, so there's a fair amount of overlap between us and that world. As far as the trends in the industries we deal with, the banks and credit unions in Minnesota are generally in pretty good shape. We have a fair amount of consolidation, which has continued for many years in that industry, but offset by a lot of new banks, especially in the metro area. We have a very vibrant economy here in the metro area, as you know. We have a lot of banks. It's a very, very competitive marketplace, which is good for the consumers. In parts of rural Minnesota, it's not quite as bright. There are areas where people are moving away and just not as many customers as there used to be, but and those banks tend to be merging over time. Most of the issues that we get involved in involving solvency of banks, credit unions, and insurance companies. We handle that pretty quietly and privately, and I know that you don't want to be reading about those kind of things in the newspaper, so we kind of try to take care of those with minimal inconvenience to the citizens. We haven't had any failures for many years in Minnesota. The mortgage industry, on the other hand, has some major challenges facing it currently. It seems like every Sunday there's an article about increasing foreclosures in the metro area, and there are also allegations of widespread fraud in that industry. And I'm going to turn this back over to Commissioner Wilson for a minute, and then we'll talk a little bit more about some of the proposals that we have concerning the mortgage industry. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Murphy, thank you. Commissioner.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. And I know we're taking a fair amount of your time, and it is so broad. But well, I think we're to the exciting part, and that's what are the challenges that we have in your committee and our department that we have to address this coming session and in the near future. Before I do, one of the things I want to do is congratulate this committee in helping get the compact passed, the National Compact for mostly life and annuity areas of our business. It is a national compact that will review and approve and speed up the process in getting product to market in those areas. One of the reasons that we thought that was important is because the insurance industry is pressing hard, as well as most congressional, not most, a lot of congressional interest, and they're taking over and regulating the insurance business like they do the banking business. We are very definitely opposed to any form of taking the state regulatory environment to Washington. In my past history, I know I've been at HUD, and I know that you can't make a consumer complaint to HUD. They ignore it, and or if you can even find somebody to answer the phone. But secondly, if you do it the way the bankers do it, the banking regulatory environment on a national level is that if you have a consumer complaint to the banking regulators, they refer it back to the bank. We don't do that. You start Nancy Link's department, as we mentioned, and walk it through Pat's area, and we aggressively follow and regulate on behalf of the consumer. So we want to protect that, and that's what the compact is. And two things, we're on the standards committee to make sure that we're represented. I took a position as an officer of the National Compact so that we can feel confident that the bylaws, the standards committee, and the management committee are represented by Minnesotans. So that's kind of an update on your passage of the compact a year ago, and again, thank you for that. In terms of a couple things going on, I think is recognition to the state and the good work that that's done here. The International Metrology Convention will be here in 07. The Minnesota is hosting the NAIC meeting in the summer of 09. And another area where the department, mostly because we're one of the few states that has suitability in their insurance law. Most states do not have it, and those that do don't enforce it very well. We worked very diligently with the state of Iowa because between Iowa and Minnesota, two-thirds of annuities are in the marketplace as a result of the companies that are domiciled in these two states. When you look back, it's a relatively new industry that's absolutely exploded in the last few years. Part of that is that my generation and younger spent a good part of their 30 years accumulating a sizable amount of money. Many of them are sophisticated so that they understand the accumulation process, but then they didn't spend 10 minutes thinking about how they're going to preserve it to last as long as their potential lifetime and how they're going to draw it out. So part of this debate is over, depending on how you measure it, the $9 trillion to $11 trillion that's invested in 401Ks, IRAs, SIPs, KEOs, and the rest, and it's managed by the securities industry. Now there's a significant interest and shift among Vanguard, insurance companies, and all articles as to how you take it out and how you preserve it. And so part of that $9 to $11 trillion is at risk for moving to the insurance community. And, of course, those that have the management of it don't want to give it up. So there's been a fair amount of infighting in between the industries. But beyond that, from a regulatory standpoint, I think that what we've tried to do, and with your help, we can continue to be a leader in the nation. In we went to work with the National Association of Security Dealers, Robert Glauber, the president, now it's Mary Shapiro, but we worked with them at meetings in New York, Washington, and Miami to get the industry to provide better accountability, better illustrations, better education of their securities salespeople, and also so that the suitability was understood. And one of the things that makes it difficult in our department in a lot of regards, but particularly here, in life insurance and annuities, often between the time that they're sold and the time that they're needed, 10, 15, 20, and more likely today, 30 years, transpires. So that by the time there's a review of that, it's hard to tell what was the real reason at the time that this was purchased. And from our department's position, we now are asking that suitability be identified at the time of the sale so that we have something to go back and look at historically. Anyway, we've taken a leadership position in that area. Another area, very quickly, catastrophic insurance. I think all Minnesotans need to know that in the area of catastrophic insurance, with all the properties along the coastlines, if you come in 50 miles from the coastline, 50% of the nation's population is represented. Therefore, about 50% of Congress, House, and Senate is in a position to shift that burden from the coastline to those of us in the Midwest. We're resisting that with everything we know how to do. If you come in 100 miles, it represents 70%. And one of the reasons that we're resisting it, just so that, you're familiar, it's my 30-year experience of having working with the National Floodplain Commission and others that the floodplain maps have been gerrymandered politically and they no longer represent the real flood risk. They're asking to shift that burden back onto us. Same way they in Florida, they have relatively good building codes as we do here in Minnesota. But Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas have either none or lousy. So we're being asked to pick up the burden for their lack of willingness to regulate their own environment. So if you hear that we've taken up the national argument on behalf of Minnesotans to protect the rates here, we have. Lastly, and one that I think that has a fair amount of public notoriety here recently, is the mortgage field. And just a little bit of background, I have about 30 years' experience in the mortgage banking industry in one fashion or another. And historically, we've been well served as citizens of this country by the state housing authorities, by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae. It's the most efficient way to get money into housing that there is in the world. And that served us well until about 5 years ago when interest rates dropped to a historic low. And you have insurance companies that we regulate, banks and others are required to have a large portion of, and retirees want to have a large portion of their reserves in bonds. When bond rate returns drop to 2%, and the insurance companies had historically put 5 into their actuarial process, they realized that, as do a lot of investors, the 2% wasn't what they had anticipated, what they expected in their retirement, or as a part of their reserve, because we marked them down in Kevin's area, and they had to boost reserves. So they were seeking out money or better return. The world's been awash with money, and particularly in this country. They come here. I was president of Ginnie Mae. They were the easiest document in the world to sell, the easiest investment, because our government is stable, our money is stable. When we have a deficit in our trade, billions of dollars are overseas to be spent and invested mostly back here. The insurance companies and others invest heavily in housing. The market was awash with money, and we invented a new industry. In the past 5 years, subprime lenders came into the market in a big way, offered money at, well, let me, Martin Weiss is one of the most reputable solvency and bank exam or rating agencies that there is. And I'll quote and close. You can already see that this is a subprime sector. This is where the borrowers got money, mortgage loans, despite bad credit, large unpaid debts, little or no down payment. This is where 12.6% have already fallen behind on their mortgage payments, and as of the last quarter of third quarter last year. Results in 2006, overall mortgage foreclosures are up by more than two-thirds, and I think that that's only the beginning. From what it was a year ago, and in 2007, don't be surprised if large companies holding these mortgages suffer severe losses. And I can tell you that there's regular articles in the Wall Street Journal today, like the Key Corporation in New York selling off their Champion division that did subprime loans, $2 billion loans. They sold them at a loss of $200 million, and they sold them with recourse. And I can assure you that that's only the beginning of the loss. This is going to be a major problem for us. And I will close by saying that while many of the losses will be in these startup firms that are now going out of business, but the hardship is that a lot of that money went into areas of our communities that can least afford to have their properties values escalated artificially. And now people that can least afford a jolt will find that in some cases their properties are not worth what's owed on them, and it's going to be a tough adjustment period. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and this committee for your indulgence and support and help in the past, and I look forward to working with all of you going forward.
Commissioner, thank you. It was lots of good information. Senator Vandiver, you have a question?
I did, Madam Chair. You mentioned the subprime lenders and the default rate. Do you know what percent of the defaulted loans are subprime loans as opposed to
50%.
Conventional?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Vandenberg. We don't have good documentation on that, and a lot of it is now only coming into the marketplace. Fortunately, it's not near as bad in Minnesota as it is in a lot of places, but I could get you that information to this committee as soon as I can develop it.
I think that would be helpful, I assume. Mr. Murphy, did you have anything more that you wanted to share with us?
I'm sorry. That was my fault. We do have a recommendation to the committee, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And I'd like to ask Kevin to present that.
Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, thanks for your patience with us. I thought I'd go through a little bit of the history of mortgage originator regulation in Minnesota and how it got to where it is today. In 1999, we began licensing mortgage originators with our Chapter 58. And under the current scheme, we license mortgage companies, and we also license individuals who operate as independent contractors. It's becoming apparent now that it's too easy to get into the mortgage business, and we have too many people that doing that that probably shouldn't be in it. In 2002, after the household finance investigation where they refunded $500 million to consumers all across the country, we added Section 58.137, where we capped the amount of fees that can be added to a loan at 5%, and we required some very blunt spoken and written disclosures on prepayment penalties. Those were the two areas that were involved with the deceptive practices. A couple of years ago, the industry proposed individual licensing of mortgage loan officers in Minnesota, and we had extensive discussions with them about that. And the reason given was to get the crooks out of the mortgage industry, which, of course, we agreed with. We gave this a lot of consideration and rejected it because it would have created a lot of process but not much payoff to the consumer, in our opinion. And we had a better idea. And our proposal was that we added Section 58.125, which required mortgage companies to do background checks on their loan officers. And it prohibited the employment of somebody who had been convicted of a financial crime without the Commerce Department's consent. So rather than deal with all of the individuals that are in this business, we thought it made more sense to deal with the exceptions. So that provision took effect in January of 06. So we've had that for about a year. We've had 14 or 15 applications. We surprisingly approved 7 of those, and the rest we either turned down or they were withdrawn or they're still pending. The ones that we did approve typically were somebody that had gotten into some trouble when they were about 20 years old, and they were now 40, and obviously they shouldn't be just barred from the industry. That provision's a substantial deterrent, but where we don't examine mortgage companies periodically, my fear is that the level of compliance is pretty low, and I believe that there's a bunch of problems out there in that arena.
Mr. Murphy, do you mean you mean the background of loan officers? And
yes, Madam Chair. Okay. I believe a lot of background checks are not being performed. I wish that were not true, but my suspicion is that that's probably true. Recently, there's been a lot of news coverage about so-called alternative mortgage products, where there's little or no money down, low teaser rates at inception that escalate sharply, loans that have negative amortization where the balance actually gets larger over time. In December, the Commerce Department issued guidelines to all the state licensed lenders concerning those kind of loans, and these loans were identical to the federal guidelines issued last fall, and the purpose was to encourage lenders to make more meaningful disclosures, more worst-case disclosures on these escalating payments, and do their underwriting based on, you know, what the payments could escalate to rather than what the teaser rates would indicate currently. So we issued that. But this year we'll probably put before you a proposal that would amount to quite a bit more intensive regulation of the mortgage industry. And we will propose that going forward, each licensee would be a corporation or a business entity. We would have significant minimum net worth requirements and or surety bond requirements. One of the issues we see is that a lot of people don't have any skin in the game. They could put a bunch of loans on the books, sell them to somebody else, and when we get complaints, we go out to check on them. That we find the place is boarded up and the people are gone, and there's not much recourse there. So if people have skin in the game, they'd be less likely to be doing those kind of things. We would propose that the Commerce Department be able to examine mortgage companies periodically and charge them for the examinations. We would require mortgage companies to maintain a perpetual roster of their loan officers and provide that list to the Commerce Department on demand. We would require 16 hours of educational training for loan officers before they can function in that capacity. And one of the big items, we'll make mortgage fraud a specific crime in Minnesota with substantial penalties. So we hope to be bringing that package to you later in the session. And that won't fix all the problems, but I think that will move it further towards where we think it ought to be. I guess so now. After giving this a fair amount of thought, we can keep passing laws to deal with inappropriate behavior in the financial world, but I think we really need to be thinking about improving economic and financial literacy for our citizens, and I believe starting in the schools is probably the best place to do that, so citizens can be better informed and be better consumers of these very complicated financial products, which I don't think are ever going to get any simpler, and the Commerce Department is actively involved in those efforts for financial literacy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Murphy, thank you. Are there any questions from members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a three-part question. When you're talking about the increase in mortgage foreclosures, I'm wondering first if you feel that that's a result of lending practices, or is it a result of falling real estate values, or both? The second question is, do we know if that's hitting certain geographic areas of our state more severely than others? And then maybe this third part of this question is beyond the scope of this committee, but I'm wondering if that the mortgage foreclosures and falling real estate values are likely to impact our property tax collection expectations in the future.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we don't have good current data on several of the questions, but they're good questions. The historically, and I believe that this is property taxes are slow to adjust downward but quick to adjust upward. That would just be a citizen's observation. But more importantly, the foreclosures historically have come from loss of job, divorce, or health problem. This is probably the first time in the mortgage industry, started big time in 1938, and it's grown, where I believe that the major changes in the way product was made available 5 years ago to current changed the threat of broadening the number of foreclosures beyond those three historic areas. And I don't think that it will affect the starter home or the first-time home buyer, whether it's rural or urban. If you are a first-time home buyer, you're on the margin, you're borrowing a high percentage loan-to-value, and your reserves are minimal, as mine were when we bought our first home, $600 down and we were in. A lot of people buy that way. I don't think that it is geographic, but it's where there's clusters of starter homes and the lower value. People on the higher end seem to have more options if they lose their overtime or whatever. I forgot the third.
I guess that was the property tax question, the part of it, and I think you answered that right at the beginning.
Yeah, so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Vandiver?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Wilson, what is the – okay, so the problem that, as you see it, with these increasing foreclosures is the product that's being offered, or it's not being represented properly to the consumer at the time that the loan is taken out, or is it – due to the economic situation, I'm not quite sure what you're talking about going after.
Well,
Commissioner.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Madam Chair and Senator Vendor. The economy of our state is very strong. I mean, in about every day, every direction you go, there's new construction and evidence that our economy is strong. On the other side of it, though, it's a little bit of both in terms of trying to qualify people. The marketplace significantly changed. There's no question in my mind about that. We have a fair number of complaints in the department that they did not understand the magnitude of the adjustment. You take a 3 or 4% starter rate. Historically, the starter rate was higher, and the opportunity to trigger up or the reset was limited to 1 or 2%. The 3 or 4% starters represented in the market in the last few years had 3% kickers, which almost doubled your payment after a 2 to 5 year period. a lot of people were qualified on the payment based on 3 or 4%. When it jumps almost, well, 75%, a lot of them are no longer qualified. And when you look at the industry, and you're part of it, Senator, the people that are involved, they're commissioned sales realtors. They're commissioned mortgage lenders. So their objective is to get people qualified. And whether or not they were as forthright, we're getting a fair number of complaints, and we're investigating those and have settled some of those cases. On the other hand, when so much money was available, I think a lot of people thought that rates were going to continue or values were going to continue to go up. They speculated. They bought for rental. There's a lot of – I don't want to go on here all day, but –
I don't mind.
But there's both sides to that, and we're looking at both sides. One side, we can defend the consumer that was misrepresented the product or misled, didn't have full information. On the other side, if you were speculating and borrowing 100%, and some were borrowing 100, 510%.
Well, Senator Vandiver.
I guess, Madam Chair, Commissioner, I just heard you're discussing an extensive new regulation and some skin in the game equity requirements. And I'm just wondering who the target is, but maybe we can talk about that more when you bring the proposals before the committee.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Yes,
well, as brief as I can be. It was too easy to get in the business. The business, all you had to do is hang a plaque out or put an ad in the paper or on TV or whatever and have lots of calls. And there was very little in terms of requirement. What we find in trying to do the best we can on behalf of the consumer is that these scoundrels are no longer there. When we show up, they disappear. It's easy to quit and go and do something else because they made, for the most part, they made good money the last 2 to 4 years. It is extremely disappointing to us when you think you have a good case, you go out and knock on the door, they answer, and you know you have decent conversation, they stiff you for a little bit of the information for a while, and when you go back or say, hey, I didn't get the follow-up information, they're gone. We want people responsible and have money in it, something to protect their reputation, but most of them are individuals.
Senator Vandiver.
Madam Chair, I think it's the originator might be gone, the person who took the application and had it signed, but I don't think the people that lent the money and are receiving the payments and have the mortgage are gone, are they?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator Vandiver. No. It's too easy for an individual to get in this business and lend the money and sell the mortgage to a servicing company. The servicing company, as in these new companies, have not done the due diligence either. That the traditional efficient lending market, when I reiterate, when it was the State Housing Authority, Fannie Mae, Ginnie Mae, and Freddie Mac, they did due diligence on where those loans were coming from. In the past 3 to 5 years, these new companies just wanted to put the loans on the books, sell them into the investment market.
Well, so,
Senator
Madam
Vandiver.
Chair, if we know who the people that designed the product or the terms of the loan, if we have them and they can't really get away or it's not a problem because then there's no loan on the property, so there's nothing to foreclose, right? So if we have those people, why do we – I mean – If that's the problem, the way the loan was designed, how come we don't have the or you would say that we have nobody to blame or we have nobody with any skin in the game? It seems like they do have quite a bit of skin in the game. They have all the money that was lent on the property. Why don't we look at those people if that's the problem?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandiver. The originator would have been the one that qualified the person, et cetera, and it may have been even if it were to the guidelines established by the mortgage company. The mortgage company that bought the loan didn't commit anything but stupidity. If they're not doing the due diligence on the loans they're buying, the loans could have met their criteria. As an example, I'll give you a perfect example. One of the companies, we had a list of 254 Social Security numbers that were submitted back to us. They thought that there was potential of fraud. And we're still in the process of verifying those. But it appears to us that already over 200 of the 254 were not verifiable. Otherwise, they're crooked. If they had been doing the due diligence that Fannie, Freddie, and Ginny and the housing authorities typically require, they'd have known it before they had 254 of them. I don't have a lot of, I don't have a lot of sympathy for the owners, the investors in these loans, the big banks and mortgage companies represented on Wall Street. I don't know how we get to them, though. They are losing their money. And a lot of them are going out of business.
Senator Olson, you have a question, comment.
Thank you. Forgive my lack of knowledge about this subject, but I'm just wondering, do these mortgage lenders have to be bonded or something like the equivalent of a bond?
I'm not aware of it. Mr. Murphy?
Madam Chair, Senator, not at this time.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Is that a recommendation you would make?
Mr. Murphy.
Madam Chair, Senator, our proposal will have a substantial net worth requirement, or a charity bond, which would serve that same function.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Any other questions for the Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Murphy, or any others? Members, then, thank you so much. Thank you to all of you from the department for sharing your knowledge and your expertise. It's very impressive what you do over there. We appreciate especially this last piece where we're talking about some issues that are very much in front of us and are of concern to us. Next Tuesday, we'll be holding a confirmation hearing. I believe that's all we'll be doing. So the commissioner will be back again with us. And then when we vote on that and submit that to the floor. I don't know if new members understand that, the House didn't do this, but the Senate confirms appointments, and that's a cool thing. So, right? Well, sure it is. So any other questions from members or anybody? Then I'm going to say the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you very much.